Right, all my settings are in place to try this.
Great, thank you. Marshall, if you could open court, please.
Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Frisch, Judge Flory, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Tuesday, October 15th, 2024. We have four cases on our calendar today. Three are set for oral argument, all via Zoom. The first one is A24-0784, In re the Supervised Estate of Nancy Eileen Flatgard. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. This is being live streamed. It is also being recorded. However, no other recordings are permitted. The recording, if you want to go back to listen to it, will be available within a day or two, and so that is available to all parties. If we do run into technical difficulties, which is with any technology may happen at times, we'll make sure to that each party has a sufficient time to present their arguments. And speaking of time, in one of the squares, you will see a clock in the marshal's box there. Can both counsel see that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, good. And that will have the time there for both of you, so you can see how much time that you have to make sure that you stay within time. Ms. Kimmel, I just wanted to check. I can see both of you. I heard Mr. Baker, but Ms. Kimmel, do you want to speak up just so I can make sure that we can hear you as well?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors.
Okay, perfect. Looks like we're ready to go. So with that, appellant's counsel, you may begin. Please begin by stating your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors and counsel. Jonathan Baker here of Baker Law Office, appearing on behalf of appellant Brian Carlson. Your Honors, as the court is aware, we're appealing from the district court's March 22nd, 2024 judgment and underlying orders in which the district court awarded respondent in excess of $50,000 in sanctions against my client, the appellant Brian Carlson. We've raised a number of issues in this appeal, but where I'd like to focus my time, obviously subject to questions from your honors, is whether the district court committed reversible error when it determined that appellant Carlson did not fall within the safe harbor provisions contained in Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 11, as well as Minnesota Statute Section 549.211. It's our contention, your honors, that to make this determination on this issue, this court must construe the phrase, and I quote, withdrawn or appropriately corrected, which is contained in both Rule 11 and also Minnesota Statute Section 549.211. On October 2nd,
But now,
2020.
Mr. Baker,
Oh, yes, go ahead, Your Honor.
yeah, if I could just stop you right there. So it seems that you make that argument for the first time in your reply brief in terms of interpreting that particular language from the rule and from the statute. So I'm not sure if that issue is actually properly before us because you can't raise issues for the first time in a reply brief. And before we even get to that issue, I'm not even sure if we need to get to that issue because I do question your standard of review. And I will readily acknowledge that it doesn't seem like there's any case law that's really directly on point, but it seems like you argue that this is an issue of law. But there is case law that says appellate courts review motions for sanctions for an abuse of discretion. And a
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt, Your Honor. Go ahead.
district court can abuse its discretion by making findings of fact that are clearly erroneous or by misapplying the law. But aren't we looking at findings of fact by the district court as to why appellant didn't meet the rule and statutory requirements of the safe harbor provision?
And sure, Your Honor. So just I think you raised a couple of questions there, and I'll do my best to answer both of them. On the issue of whether we raised the standard of review in our principal brief, I would point the court to page 13 of our principal brief regarding the interpretation issue, where we've cited Gams v. Houghton regarding this standard of review for interpretation of rules of civil procedure. And then, Your Honor, regarding the standard of review, it is our contention that to make the determination of whether my client's October 2nd, 2023 email did bring him within the safe harbor provisions of the rule and the statute, which are substantively identical, the district court and this court would have to construe the operative language in the rule and the statutory provision. But I would,
But
oh.
counsel, whether something is withdrawn is a question of fact, depending on the circumstances of the case. I read all of the cases that you cited on pages 14 and 15 of your principal brief, and every single one of those cases engages in a factual analysis to determine whether the offending assertion was withdrawn. It wasn't determined as a matter of law. So I think to Judge Reyes's point, what's your best authority for the proposition that the question of whether an offending document or an offending position has been withdrawn is a question of law for the district court?
Well, I think the absence of any authority in Minnesota is my best authority for this, in that we do not see any court of higher jurisdiction or any district court opinion that I've found, Your Honor, that addresses what does it mean to withdraw or correct a submission under the rule and the statute. That said,
Isn't
Your Honor.
that because whether something is withdrawn depends upon what the submitter does to withdraw the offending position or document?
Certainly, Your Honor, I would concede that there's always going to be a factual inquiry in terms of whether there was a withdrawal or a correction to fall within the safe harbor provision, certainly. But I do believe, Your Honor, that to make that determination, we have to apply the language of the rule and the statute. So whether it's a pure question of law, mixed question of law or fact, I believe that this court could look that at that under a de novo review standard.
Well,
As just oh, go ahead.
let's look at what your client actually did here. So on September 5th, Ms. Kimmel notified your client that sanctions motions would be forthcoming if the matter wasn't withdrawn. And then on September 15th, he was told again because there was no response and still nothing happened. So then the motion was filed on September 18th and still nothing happened. And then there was an email that came from your client saying he was going to withdraw something as written, but it wasn't withdrawn, and no, nothing happened until sometime later in October after the safe harbor provision had expired. So why is it erroneous or unsupported by the record or inconsistent with legal authority for the district court to say you didn't withdraw your offending claim in the safe harbor period, given
Sure.
those facts? And I think I have the facts correct.
I think you do, Your Honor. I don't have any reason to correct the facts. A couple of things, Your Honor. I think what you had one thing you asked in your question was, how would it be inconsistent with legal authority to say that he had not withdrawn? As we had cited, Your Honor, the cases on page 14 and 15 of our brief, our principal brief, we've scoured, obviously Minnesota first, and then nationally, to look to how other courts have handled these situations. And again, nothing in Minnesota, but the federal cases that we were able to find, which I've spent a lot of time looking, and I would assume Ms. Kimmel has as well, appear to determine in factually similar circumstances that an email of the nature that my client did send on October 2nd of 2023, where he says, "I withdraw the petition as written and will submit appropriate documentation on my return," would suffice to bring a party within the protections of the safe harbor period that's contained in both Minnesota Rule 11 and also Section 549.211. So I understand. Oh, go ahead, Your Honor.
Counsel, to Ms. Kimmel's point, I think that the argument there is that the withdraw as written and then the subsequent request for clarification as to what that means without any response, when the district court says that's equivocating and not a commitment to withdraw the petition in its totality or the offending position in its totality, that's not really withdrawing the offending document as it's similar to the circumstances in the cases on pages 14 and 15. Do you want to address that?
Yeah, certainly, Your Honor. I guess, you know, my position in the way he wrote that email is the only submission appellant had in the case was his petition as written. So certainly you could word it a number of different ways. He could have said, I withdraw the petition, period. He added the two words as written. I don't think that changes the intent in terms of, is this a withdrawal or not?
So then what about the fact that the foreclosure proceeding was still ongoing, or that there were other proceedings that were asserting essentially the same offending position that were not, there was no commitment to withdraw or dismiss those submissions?
Certainly, Your Honor. So the issue with the foreclosure proceeding, if you look back, and I believe we've cited to the record on this, at the actual notice of motion and motion that was served on my client on September 18th, 2023, only asked my client to withdraw the petition that had been submitted in the probate case of Ms. Flatgard, the case that we're appealing from here. The foreclosure action and the notice of intervention really only came about when the parties began actually substantively briefing respondents' motion for sanctions. So as of September 18th, when my client was served with the notice of motion and motion for sanctions, which is the statutory mechanism you have to follow to begin the safe harbor period, to put a party on notice what you're asking to be withdrawn or corrected, the only thing that had been mentioned was the petition. So I agree with you.
I think you're right about that, counsel, but my question was a little bit more nuanced than that, and that is, the fact that the offending position was maintained in other actions, I think, was part of the original Rule 11 motion. If you look at page 3 of the memorandum of law in support of the motion for sanctions, Ms. Kimmel does cite that the filing of the notice of intervention is related sanctionable conduct, and the fact that that wasn't withdrawn evinces the intent not to actually withdraw the offending document in the petition that as noticed in Rule 11. So do you want to address that?
And I'll do my best to address it, Your Honor. And the way I would frame it is that when we are looking at Rule 11 and how it's supposed to operate, the party seeking sanctions needs to put the allegedly offending party on specific notice of what it deems to be sanctionable, which is my understanding of reading the rule and the underlying case law. That particular submission was not raised until we began briefing the sanctions motion. Mr. Carlson did indeed withdraw his submissions in that foreclosure action following the briefing. So had that particular submission been raised in that original notice of motion and motion, certainly he may have addressed that in his October 2nd, 2023 email. I can't hypothesize what he might have done, but on the record in front of the court, it wasn't raised. And he did, in our opinion and with our argument, he did address the document that he was requested to withdraw, and he did indeed withdraw it. And Your Honor, a couple other things to point to. This is in direct relation to your question. I just want to highlight the circumstances of, you know, what was going on when Mr. Carlson did send this email. He was on vacation. He was, as he had said in his email, did not have ready access to internet and email. He had a moment where he did. He didn't have a computer, any ability to actually do anything further.
I appreciate that that's what he says, but the district court made credibility determinations about that, and I think we're obligated to adhere to the district court's credibility determinations.
Sure. And the other related issue is on October 4th, he was disqualified from further representing himself in the matter. So it's our position his hands were factually tied.
Right. But counsel, he was aware that that motion was pending and that motion was going to be decided. Motion for disqualification was going to be decided while he was on vacation. So he did have notice beforehand that that was a potential outcome. In addition to the fact that that same action occurred in the prior probate proceeding regarding his brother. I want to come back to a couple things. One is, I agree with you that you did argue in your initial brief that review should be de novo. So I don't think that's that issue. But listening to the conversation, which is helpful, I think, seems to point to the fact that what the district court did was make underlying factual findings. He talked about in the district court's order, the district court talked about appellant being cagey at using the as written term. He talked about how he that could be it was ambiguous in terms of what that was meant. But I think more importantly, the district court noted that appellant had several opportunities to reply, to clarify issues, including after that email had been sent. Appellant had the opportunity, Ms. Kimmel sent a follow-up email, and he never replied to clarify whether or not he was unequivocally going to be withdrawing everything. And so those sound like factual findings by the district court. Why is that not correct?
Your Honor, I agree. If you look at the district court's order, there are a number of factual findings. And I see I'm about a time, so I'll try and wrap this up really quickly, Your Honor. But a couple of things there. One, Your Honor, you pointed to a district court could abuse its discretion when it misapplies the law. We think the district court misapplied the law in determining whether or not this was a withdrawal of a claim. The other piece, Your Honor, is that in the October 4th response, it appears to me that what respondent was essentially requesting or demanding was a dismissal with prejudice. Promise me that you're not going to try and bring some alternative form relief, a different claim, different theories. You need to tell me you're gone for good. All the rule requires is to correct or withdraw the submission that has been noted in a notice of motion in motion. We've also cited case law from other jurisdictions that a dismissal with prejudice is not required to bring one within the safe harbor period. Simply withdrawing the submission that was noted in a sanctions motion would be sufficient. And that's my answer on that point, Your Honor. And with that, I will stop because I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Kimmel, you have 15 minutes. When you begin, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors and counsel. My name is Kathy Kimmel, and along with my colleague, Amy Papenhausen, who is in my office with me during this hearing, we represent Fiduciary Foundation, which is the personal representative of the estate of Nancy Flatgard, formerly the special administrator of the estate of Nancy Flatgard. The Hennepin County District Court did not abuse its discretion in granting sanctions against appellant for violating Rule 11 and Section 549.211, where appellant's pleadings failed to satisfy the standards set forth in the rule and the statute, where appellant failed to withdraw or correct the offending documents within the safe harbor period. Having considered appellant's disclosed financial considerations along with the other factors, the district court did not abuse its discretion in determining that significant sanctions were warranted against appellant for deterrent purposes. The district court's granting of the motion for sanctions and the district court's order granting in part attorney's fees should be affirmed. There was significant time spent in argument about whether the October 2nd email from appellant withdrew or corrected the offending document, as the district court found it did not. And it didn't abuse its discretion in so deciding that for a number of reasons. The first point is his email did not withdraw or correct. It was equivocal. He was hedging on whether he was going to withdraw that statement. And that email puts him at stark contrast to the four cases that are cited in appellant's brief relating to when the court has found unequivocal withdrawals, despite the fact there wasn't a finding or a filing to that effect.
Ms. Kimmel, one of the things that I considered when I was reading these materials is that the district court perhaps had a context that maybe we don't see, given the history of the proceedings with respect to this matter. Is there something that we're not seeing in this record that perhaps might inform the district court's view of what this email means, or the as written portion of that email might mean? Is there some history that we're not aware of because we don't have access to the entire record?
Yes, I do believe that's the case, but I also think there is clear references in the record that support the district court finding that, as it articulates in it's paragraph 61 of its order, it's the addendum, page 20, where it says, under the circumstances, the personal representative reasonably construed Mr. Carlson's message as stating he would continue to assert claims and remedies against the estate of some nature. This court, under the circumstances, and those circumstances were, this court, as did we, have to look at the entire proceeding that underlied this one, which is the estate of Wade Scott Carlson. There are many, many submissions. And even in that case, as in here, Mr. Carlson, the appellant, makes statements that are constantly shifting. The sand beneath his feet changed with respect to facts he says are true, positions he says were taken, decisions with respect to the court that were or were not found. And I draw some points here that are readily before this court, and that is he is constantly changing and contradicting himself as to when he first learned about the motion for sanctions and first learned when those would be brought relative to his vacation. It is clear, as Your Honor just noted, I first gave him notice. This is not in the record. I gave him notice actually in August. I'm not going to go into that. It's not in the record. But on September 5th, which is in the record, I gave him notice that we would be pursuing sanctions against him if the petition was not withdrawn. This is pretty early in the case. And it's pretty early. You're going to say, boy, you all did a lot in a short period of time. And the reason being is we had seen 3 years of litigation that went all the way up to really the Supreme Court. And to truncate this, to really hit it hard and to end this proceeding without going through discovery and a trial, we brought motions, three dispositive motions, pretty heavy early on. After the September 5th email, I sent an email because in my September 5th email to appellant, I indicated the motion would be brought on September 15th. That didn't happen. And so on September 15th, I advised that it would be brought the next week, which it was. And to this point, I want to correct a misstatement by Mr. Baker. In the September 18th notice of motion and motion that I served but did not file, I specifically stated that the motion for sanctions would be brought pursuant to Rule 11 and Section 549.211 on the basis of the petition and on the basis of the notice of intervention filed by Mr. Carlson in the U.S. Bank foreclosure action. It is specifically in the notice and motion and in the brief and in all of the supporting documents that I served on him on September 18th. Now, the tricky part about this oral argument, so I wanted to correct that false statement. So at all times, Mr. Carlson knew the foundation of the motion was going to be on both things. Now, the tricky part about it is this court does not have it in the record because I served it without filing it because that's what I'm required to do. I couldn't file the first service, the safe harbor period. But he was on notice. And as
Miss Kimmel, I do have that document in front of me. Can you just point to me where that is?
yes, on the motion, it's like the second page. So under motion, it says the special administrator will move the court for an entry of order imposing sanctions on Brian Carlson pursuant to Rule 11 and 549. It then has a quote. It says the related to the petition. And on the flip side of the second page of the motion, it says, and the notice of intervention filed by Mr. Carlson in
I'm
the
sorry, can you just help me? What does the paragraph start with?
See, my concern, Your Honor, is you don't have it. It is not in the record
Oh, I
because
mean,
I
I have a document that's notice of motion, a motion for sanctions by Fiduciary Foundation in its capacity as PR, this document.
yes, and
Isn't that the notice of motion?
that's the motion, notice of motion, a motion that was filed in, thank you for showing it to me, that was filed on in October. But the notice of motion and motion that was served on September 18th was different in that it had a specific other provision relating to the notice of foreclosure.
And that's not in the record.
It's not in the record because it can't be in the record. I filed it. I served it, didn't file it. But to the point, he knew at all times that it related to both proceedings. I also want to address again this notion of did the district court err in or abuse its discretion is the appropriate standard when it found that the October 2nd did not withdraw or correct. I want to address some other shifting positions of the appellant that supported the court's determination that his position was cagey. It hedged. And that is, you can see even in his appellate filings, he is shifting as to when he found out about the motion for sanction, about what he could do with it, whether he had internet access, whether he didn't have internet access, whether he knew about it before his vacation, when his vacation started, whether he at one point he denied having any ability to have communication. That's been scaled back. Now, at no time does he ever deny that he didn't have the ability to pick up the phone and call me. He never did. He didn't do it on September 5th. He didn't do it at any time before the 15th. He didn't do it when I served the motion on the 18th. He didn't do it at any time after I served the motion until he left on his vacation. And point in fact, he actually served his opposition brief to the DQ motion on September 21st. At various times, he said he was already on vacation and he didn't have internet access. Well, if he didn't have internet access as of the 18th, how could he have filed electronically his opposition to the brief on the 21st? And how could he have sent me the email on October 2nd?
Ms. Kimmel, if I could stop you there, because I would note that the district court also found that appellant could have called even if he didn't have internet access. But listening to what you're explaining, it sounds like you're talking about factual findings by the district court. Would that be accurate?
Yes.
Okay,
Actual.
so yeah, and in your brief, you mentioned that you think the standard of view is abuse of discretion. Appellant argues it's de novo. But would you agree that, well, I think case law is clear that we look at motions for sanctions under abuse of discretion standard. However, a district court can abuse its discretion in one of two ways, by misapplying the law or making factual findings that are clearly erroneous and not supported by the record. It sounds to me, and I don't want to put words in appellant's mouth, but it sounds to me that he's essentially arguing that the district court abuses discretion by misapplying the law. And it sounds to me like you are essentially arguing that the district court did not abuse its discretion because its factual findings are supported by the record. Would that be a fair interpretation or not?
Yes, I believe of both positions. The court had to, in order to find that the safe harbor, that there had not been a withdrawal of the offending motion, had to have made a determination there wasn't a withdrawal. The court did find that. That's paragraph 61 of the court's order at addendum page 20. And the court also has some additional findings on that. So, yes, the court had to have made the determination that the withdrawal had not occurred by way of the October 2nd email. The facts that the court looked at with the discretion that's afforded the court. And I think, too, Judge Frisch's point, there is a credibility determination that the court meant when it was construing the as written. If he had meant to unequivocally withdraw the petition, there would have been a period after petition. And that sets him in sharp contrast with those other cases that appellant cited, where, for example, in the Fisk case, the claimant said he would withdraw the complaint without preconditions. In the Carruthers case, the plaintiff sent a stipulation to withdraw the offending document. In the Harding case, there was notice of intent to dismiss with prejudice. And in the Marabit case, the plaintiff stated intent to withdraw the claim unequivocally, stating that he would be filing a notice of voluntary dismissal. Those are unequivocal. In contrast, you had the hedging. And what happened in the interim time period is the district court granted the disqualification motion, and he was required to retain counsel.
Ms. Kimmel, I have one last question. Do we need to interpret the quote withdrawn or appropriately corrected end quote language from the rule and the statute in order to decide this issue?
No.
Why
All you
not?
do is apply the facts to the law. You're not needing to interpret it. No one's arguing withdraw or correct is ambiguous, is unclear in some respects. What you need to do is to determine whether the court abused its discretion when it awarded the sanctions because there had not been a withdrawal. So you are not interpreting, you are looking at the court's application of facts to the words that are not viewed as ambiguous or needing any interpretation. And with that, I would ask that the court affirm the district court's two orders that are on appeal. And my time, I see, is now up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kimmel. We will turn now back to Mr. Baker. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few quick things. Your Honor, we've talked a lot about the, Your Honors, we've talked a lot about the standard of review. If the court is going to review this purely as an abuse of discretion standard, one thing I would like to point out to the court is if indeed we're relying so much on the district court's many nuanced findings calling appellants September, or sorry, let me correct that, October 2nd email cagey. We did note for the court that the district court adopted verbatim the proposed order and findings that respondent put in front of it, which under precedent from this court does call into question how thoroughly the district court actually reviewed the facts that exist in the case.
But it
Well,
didn't
counsel.
award all of the sanctions that were requested, though, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that was in the second round of briefing that occurred after the court had indeed awarded respondent sanctions, and we were requested to brief the amount of sanctions. So yes, in that case, it's correct. The court didn't adopt that particular proposed order verbatim. So my point being that the notion that I disagree with the notion that that my client's October 2nd email was cagey. He indicated that he withdrew the petition as written. There was nothing further for him to withdraw that he had submitted in the case at that time.
Well,
And I do
counsel,
think.
I mean, I think your argument might have some merit if the district court just wholesale adopted the proposed order that he had asked from both parties. That's when district courts have gotten into trouble. But he latched onto one word, and the district court went further by noting that the language from that email could easily be construed as him continuing to assert claims against the state. The district court also noted that he failed to reply to clarify at any point, including after that email. And the district court also noted that appellant had a history of quote, giving demonstrably misleading and conflicting information, end quote, and pointed to some of the instances in which the appellant had done that. So it seems to me the question is whether or not the district court's factual findings, plural, are supported by the record. Are there any findings that are not supported by the record?
Your Honor, again, I would say my interpretation of my client's email is that it was not cagey. I don't think adding two words to the end of a sentence turns something cagey. And I think, and let me go back, Your Honor, this isn't a direct answer to your question, but we were talking earlier about the district court could abuse its discretion by misapplying the law. And in our view, Your Honor, the district court has set up what I think could be a troubling standard for litigants in this state, where if a party has been put on notice that it has a submission that is potentially sanctionable, to hold over that party's head that it may that that party may consider asserting some sort of alternative relief or an amended petition in the future after withdrawing the one that has been noted as potentially sanctionable as a basis for continuing to allow a party to get sanctions against a client, I think is problematic. Parties should have the right to pursue alternative claims of relief, perhaps withdraw something they've submitted, seek counsel, and perhaps submit an alternative form. And I think the district court has set up a bit of a dangerous standard here, where the mere possibility that a party may pursue alternative forms of relief allows a court to impose sanctions when that party has said, "Hey, I withdraw what has been submitted to the court," and the district court says, "Well, it looks like you might do something different in the future, so we're going to go ahead and sanction you anyway." I think that is a dangerous precedent to set. I think it's inconsistent with the text of Rule 11 and Minnesota Statute 549.211 and the
Well,
case
counsel,
law that we've cited.
I think your argument would have merit if we adopted it as a rule of law, applying a de novo standard versus looking at the particular facts and circumstances of each case to see whether or not they meet the Rule 11 and the statutory requirements.
Yeah, Your Honor, that's a fair point. And I would just go back to say if this court looks at this as an abuse of discretion and whether, under the guise of whether the district court misapplied the law and looks to how other courts have handled this at similar circumstances in other jurisdictions, interpreting the nearly identical federal rule, I think we can get to a point where we could say this October 2nd email was sufficient to bring appellant within the protections of the safe harbor. And whether the district court erred or abused its discretion, I think we could get to the same result. And I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor, so I'll stop my comments there.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you both for your briefing and your oral arguments. It was a very helpful conversation to have today, so we appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. That is, we will have a break between this case and the next one, so the court is in recess until the next oral argument. Thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honors.